This episode of the Book of Very, Very Bad Things podcast has been brought to you by our sponsors at Sweet Cheetah Publicity. Sweet Cheetah is a PR collective that values people over profit. They put a different spin on public relations by working primarily with friends and using all profits to aid charitable organizations. With a roster that includes Jawbox, The New Amsterdams, Brainiac, Get Some, Funeral Date, Damian Dunn, and many more artists, record labels, and podcasts. Sweet Cheetah. That's a great PR cohort. You can find them on social media by simply searching Sweet Cheetah PR, and they'll be there. He's been Tim. I've been Peter. And Sweet Cheetah has been beautiful. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Book of Very, Very Bad Things podcast. I'm your host, Peter, and I am still here. And tonight, I dedicate this episode to the memory and life of Eddie Sutton Pomponio, Eddie Leeway. Eddie was the vocalist of the hardcore crossover band Leeway. He was in Marauder. He was in a few bands. Eddie was a big force in my life. His music inspired me. His friendship emboldened me. I love Eddie. I'm going to miss Eddie. And Carl, tonight's subject, was a good friend of Eddie's as well. Carl Golombeski started out his musical trajectory in the hardcore scene in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. He owned a club along with a few friends called Homebase, where some legendary shows took place. The Wilkes-Barre Festival had its birth between the walls of Homebase. Along with scene luminaries like Bob Mack, they kicked off what would become eventually the Positive Numbers Fest. Tonight, we discuss his life and music today, working for the likes of Madonna, Mary J. Blige, and Beyonce. Even more importantly, we discuss his spiritual trajectory, his discovery of Ram Dass, his plans to kind of work his way out of pop music and into a life with more spiritual integrity. He started out a punk rocker, hardcore kid. He was in the band An Albatross, a band that was made up of friends and ex-bandmates of mine. They went on to some acclaim, and they are back together, thankfully. We get into a lot of personal things, a lot of very Pennsylvania-centric things that may go over some of your heads. But if you are interested in the story of a human being who started off dabbling in creating electronic music, putting on hardcore shows, and even more importantly, discovering his vocation, discovering his spirituality, this is going to be an epic conversation in two parts. So, as I said, I dedicate this to Eddie, but I also dedicate it to the people of the Wilkes-Barre and Scranton, Pennsylvania hardcore scene. We are some of the most strange, interesting, and wonderful people that ever walked the face of this planet, and I'm not just saying it because I'm one of them. We've gone on to do some very incredible things, some of us. And I wouldn't trade that group of friends or that time in my life for literally anything. Carl's an interesting guy. He's a funny human being, and he is infectious in his positivity. That's how you know the spiritual things he talks about are not a front. And he comes from very humble beginnings, very embattled beginnings, living a life under a family unit that was rife with mental illness and uncertainty. He found a way to rise above it and to be a positive human being, which is incredibly inspiring to me. If you like this podcast, if you love this content, if you want to hear more like it, like, rate, subscribe wherever you listen, give us a review, rate us. If you're really into it, head over to Instagram, Facebook, share my content, make a comment, and please, if you really, really, really feel like helping us out, you want to see us continue, head over to my Depop, which will be listed in the body of the episode. Just look it up online when you're listening to the show. I have stuff for sale there. A lot of records, band t-shirts, fashions. We're clearing house in order to bring to you more shows, more content, and our much storied soundtrack compilation mixtape release that'll be coming out sometime very, very soon on Summer Darling Tapes. Carl's a great guy. Carl's an old friend. This entire episode is all about friendship, all about life, spirituality, love, and music, which is what this whole show is about. So, my friends, without further ado, I give to you Carl G., Carl Golombeski, on the book of Very, Very Bad Things Podcast. All right, we'll start from the top. I'm sorry.
From the tippy.
Yeah, from the tip. Nice coil shirt, by the way. That's fantastic.
It's a great one, right?
Oh, God, I love them so much. I love them so much. Chris and Cozy, like that whole group of people, they just astound me.
I know, right?
I found them. I was a kid. I was pretty young, anyway. And I was ordering from Relapse Records way back when they were still in like Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, and they did those Lost themes to Hellraiser that Clive Barker commissioned from them, and he never. And the studio never wanted to use them because they thought they were too creepy.
Huh.
Too uncommercial for Hellraiser.
Wow. So
they got scrapped, and Relapse had their hands on those recordings, and I got them, and that was it. I was into Coil therein.
Wow.
But, yeah. Yeah. You should check that out if you ever find. Well, I think they're online now.
Yeah, I mean, the Throbbing Gristle stuff I got into with Vito. Me and Vito got turned on to Throbbing Gristle when we were kind of younger. It was so wild, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I have a Temple of Psychic Youth ring.
That's fucking amazing. They were nuts. They were into, like, what was that church they were way into?
Temple of Psychic Youth.
Well, yeah, but they based it off of something else that...
Crowley's stuff and all that kind of, like,
yeah.
Mythology. Yeah, like, they, like... But Genesis had such a wild thing. Like, did you ever see his exhibit he did at the Tibetan Museum in New York?
Yeah.
The Rubin? Like,
yep.
That was fucking amazing. I went to that. I was so blown away. Like, tried to alter everything, he called it. ALTAR, everything. And I was like, wow. Like, he just has these amazing concepts of art and the way to look at things that's so transcendent.
Mm-hmm.
He always been like that.
And then, like, you know, his other half passes away and he decides to assume her identity and integrate it into himself.
Yes.
Breast implants, changes his name to Genesis Breyer Peorage. Like, wow. Incredible. Incredible human.
It's an enigma to me. He's amazing. Like, he became his art form.
Yeah.
You know?
To exist on a plane where human beings could self-actualize to the point where they become their own art.
Yeah.
Just to witness it in a few people only is phenomenal to me, yeah. But it's just so few and far between.
Yeah.
It takes an extreme artist to, you know, self-actualize in that manner anyway. But I can't think of anybody else who would really fit that bill quite the same way.
No. I mean...
As Genesis did, anyway.
Yeah, I guess you have, like, David Bowie and stuff, Brian Eno.
Yeah, but even they didn't take it
quite... Not so extreme, man.
Yeah.
he pushes all the boundaries.
Mm-hmm. What a loss. What an incredible loss to, to art and music. Yeah. And kept strange company, too. Like, hung around with some very odd human beings in the music sphere. Yeah. That really don't even make sense alongside of him, but I don't know.
Have you read his memoirs? Like, there's a memoirs book. And mm-hmm. It kind of sounds like his voice in the audiobook. I have the audiobook version. It's, like, very similar. And wow, like, what a wild thing. Like, him writing the letters and, like, just his whole path as, like, a young person. He was so, like, uniquely charged even back then.
Yeah, to come out of an era, too, where, like, Throbbing Gristle did not have a basis for comparison to make music so left of center, so caustic and experimental, and that's putting it mildly when you say experimental when it comes to Throbbing Gristle. But, you know, what's the name of the first record? 20 Jazz Greats or something like that?
Yeah, 20 Jazz Greats.
Yes. There's... What a way to present it that really throws people completely off. You look at the cover.
It looks like a Beach Boys cover back then, you know? Like,
they're on like this hillside.
So twisted.
Oh, it's...
It's genius.
It's genius. There's no other way to put it. And, you know, growing up the way we did in the scene that we did, people don't understand because I think the connotations that come along with hardcore now... it tends to call to mind like a thuggishness or a lack of vision. You know, we just do this. We just live like this and make this racket. When we were kids, like late 80s, early 90s, we were explorers. We were searching for anything.
Straight up. I was going on musical pilgrimages.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, like, and fucking me and Vito in high school, you know what I mean? We went to school together. We were the weirdos and it wasn't, it wasn't this thing where like you walked around like a tough guy cause you were into that music. It was just like, well, we found this because it's an extreme, you know, exaltation of spirituality and emotion. These are people who are, they're trying to find something. They're seekers just like me. That's why I identify with it. They're not just like singing about Dungeons and Dragons and stuff like a lot of the metal bands.
Yeah, like it was the first time I ever in my life I felt like I got let in on a secret.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like I wish I'd dug it out to show you, but I have a picture of you from when you were like 14 or 15 wearing this shirt in a bathtub. Oh. You're hunched down in a bathtub with a New York Yankees cap on and this shirt on. And I'm like, yeah, that's Carl when we were a little kid.
I got to see this picture.
I got to dig it out. I got to dig it out and send it to you. But like, I just remember like you guys are a little bit like, I think you're a little bit younger than me even, aren't you?
I'm 44.
Yeah. I'm 48.
Okay.
I remember like seeing
you. I was always the youngest person around when I was there, like Johnny Dudek,
mm-hmm.
Paddock, Pulaski, all these get Nash. Everybody was a little older than me. They kind of just took me around because I was wild enough to like run around with them and shit. And I could always fit on the center. Like, you know, those like armrests that would fold down. Everybody would meet at like the mall. Remember like at the mall and then everybody hop in cars. And sometimes there wasn't enough for everybody to go to the shows. Like they're going to New York City or they're going to Syracuse. But I always got in a car because they let me sit on the little armrests and shit. So I always got in one of the cars. That's how I go to all the shows with everybody, like outside of Pennsylvania. They'd always let me in. And I think they kind of like thought it was funny, you know, like this little munchkin motherfucker hopping in the middle seat. Like, yeah, come on, get in, you know.
To me, like there was always like you were always excited about everything. You like you were one of the very few people that I knew, like, because like I was always with Hudok and I love Jay to death, but he's always bummed. Jay's always bummed. just, oh, Peter, oh, oh God damn it. You know, like, you were always excited about everything, and like everything was an adventure for you. So it was kind of infectious. Like it almost didn't make sense when you'd be with Naylor all the time, because Naylor was the same way. He was always just like, oh, great guy, but he was like pissed about it.
Yeah, I don't know why. I always have this curiosity.
You know what? I think it led you to some pretty unique places. I mean,
I still am like this all the time. You know, like I was just so wild in these harmonic things that I've been studying, and I've like been staying up to almost 6-7 in the morning the past couple of days, just like in this like crazy discovery, and I'm like enamored by it. And I still feel the same way.
That's an incredible thing to hang on to.
I know. It's just part of me, I guess. Like I just have this curiosity. I never get bored.
Is that kind of what led you, like, because when we were pretty young, you really diversified quickly, and you started moving into like ambient and electronic musics and started creating it.
Yeah.
How did that switch take place for you? Was it finding things like Throbbing Purple?
It's funny. Do you remember Liz Cerise?
Yeah.
So I just saw Liz in Vegas when we were doing our show there. I haven't seen her in so many years. Like, we went on such different paths. And, like, I hit her up. We were just talking. I was like, hey, I'm coming to Vegas. We should have tea, you know? And, like, she is the person responsible for taking me to the rave in 1994. So she had gone to the rave with Johnny Dudek and Chris McDonald and Tina Skibber and Dave Sainthart. They were all going to the rave, and it was just like these things in New York and the warehouse and shit. And she was like, you got to go. And it's funny because I was making like a scrapbook, and I have the flyer, the exact flyer with her handwriting on it that says, you got to go to this. And it's like February 25th, 1994. I still have the flyer. Like, I just came across it recently. And I was like, I thought it was like so cheesy. The only thing I could imagine, like, I didn't know drum machines existed. I didn't know synthesizers existed. I had a really small musical knowledge. I had gotten a guitar, you know, like that I had, like my friends were playing guitar, Tony Krishka, Dominic, these guys are all playing guitar. And I was like, I got to get a guitar. And like, I got a guitar and I had no clue how to play it. I never took lessons. I hated lessons and things like this. I didn't like music theory. So I would just listen to like Pearl Jam and I would try to sound it out. Like I would find the note and just sit there forever, right? And figure out like ways to play it in my own little hokiness. And then Dominic sometimes would teach me little leeway songs. Like, people would teach me little things, and I could just do whatever they taught me, right? I had a good sense of rhythm, and I could figure things out. And when I went to the rave, I imagined it was like CNC Music Factory or something, right? It was all I could picture, like, for dance music. It was like this cheesy, popular dance music that was on MTV and stuff, right? It was like... Yeah. And Madonna songs and things like this. And I was like, I don't think I want to go to the rave. Like, it just sounds horrible. And she was just like so adamant, like, you got to go. We took ecstasy and LSD together. And like, I had just taken LSD for the first time when I was like 15, like right around there. Somebody brought LSD from the Pink Floyd concert. Mm-hmm. Gave me some Beavis and Butthead acid.
I remember Beavis and Butthead acid.
Yeah, they gave me some Beavis and Butthead acid and fucking... And I was just like, you know, turned on the LSD. And like, by that time, I had already been listening to Shelter records and stuff, right? We had gone to the Krishna temple. So like, there had been thoughts already put into me from like 12 years old to 13 years old to 14. You know, now I'm 50. So 3 years of like Into Another songs and Leeway songs and like, you know, Shelter's talking about I'm not this body.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm 12. I'm not this body. I'm 12 years old, right? And then I take acid and I'm like, oh my God, like what they're saying is totally different. Those things are in my head, those phrases, right? They're like serenagati. And then I think like it was insane to think. I'm like, wow, it's like things really got put into my being so young. And then you take LSD. And these things are inside of you, and you consider them in different ways, right? Almost experiential ways. Yeah. And then, like, they took me to the rave, and I just saw, like, people DJing electronic music, and it was so intense the way that it pushed my body and made me feel in my body, right? And it wasn't like there wasn't like this aggressive nature to the whole thing. Like, there was an aggressiveness in the hardcore scene sometimes that was a little much for me, because I was like this small little kid. Like,
yeah,
I was smaller than everybody, I was younger than everybody. And, like, people would protect me at the concert sometimes a lot, you know, bring me up on the stage or put me in a, but sometimes, no, I get like a fucking foot to the head or something, you know, like I would get beat up a little bit at those places. And when I saw, like, all the people taking care of each other, it was, like, a whole different thing. Like, you go to the bathroom, like, I'm a 15-year-old kid, high as shit on LSD and ecstasy. And, like, one Dominic is there, and Amy Bezik is with me, and Liz, all together at the rave for the first time. And I'm like, what is this? Like, what is this going on? Like, I thought they were manipulating guitar music records, like, Steve Miller Band and fucking whatever the rock and roll songs are out there, right? I'm thinking they're manipulating the record somehow to get these sounds, and I'm so blown away and I'm so tripped out. And then the whole night we stay there, we leave and we drive home, and I'm still hearing these sounds in my head, like in the car, like I'm hearing the patterning of the sounds, like in the car, like I'm still hearing like these chugging synthesizer sounds in my head, because it was so many hours of it. And you're on psychedelics. So it just like embeds itself in you. And then I got home and I was like, had that stuff in my head, and I grabbed my guitar and I was like banging on it with like pencils and like thinking like, how the fuck did they make those sounds? I was so blown away. How did they make those sounds? And I swear to God, that's the curiosity that never left me. How did they make those sounds?
That's fucking amazing, because, you know, like to have such an like diametrically opposed experiences and to come to a realization like that, and you know, something, it sounds so simple, like how did they do that? But that's the mother of every invention ever.
Straight up. But yeah, it put me on a whole life path.
Yeah. So like you go to that show, it sets you on this quest of discovery of sound that leads you into creating your own music then, correct?
Yeah, we had to like get first. I mean, dude, we used to rob music stores to try to get synthesizers. Like we broke a window of a fucking music store as kids and like tried to steal a Moog synthesizer out of it. Like a heist. We did a fucking heist. Like we were so poor and so driven that we were like, we have to figure this out. So I eventually got this opportunity to go to California. We skipped high school. They picked me up at my bus stop, and we drove to California, and Ranji had a hookup for some LSD, and we bought 10 sheets of LSD, and I told the girl that I would sell it for her at the raves if she would buy me a drum machine. And that's how I got my 808 drum machine, was I sold acid and then got enough money from the acid to buy the drum machine. Actually, I was trying to buy a Prophet 5 from a guy in 44 that had it on Craigslist. And when I got to him, he said it was stolen or he sold it. I don't know if he sold it and he was just saying it got stolen. There was this drama with it like getting stolen supposedly. And then I couldn't buy it. So Vince gave me like another extra $100 from working at the tattoo shop.
Mm-hmm.
And that funded my 808. And then I went and bought an 808 and I just used to program the drum machine. And we got MC202 also. And just, we had just a couple synthesizers, me and Vito. We had like these little synths, and we would like anybody who's having a house party, we found out about like we can get to, we would just go to their house and plug in their tape machine. Like we had one of those tape deck to 1/8-inch cables with a little mixer and our drum machines, and we just go over to people's kitchens and like do live performances in their kitchens we plugged into their tape deck. Like we would do anything to just go somewhere and do this with other people watching us, you know what I mean? Like we were just so enamored by it, and so like, you know, had this punk attitude of like, fuck it, let's just go do it. We had done it with little bands and things, and we were like, well, this was way easier. We didn't need to gather any people. We just had to get our machines, a little bit of electricity, and a tape deck, and we can get going.
God damn. and that ends up turning into what became an institution in this area, Home Base.
Yeah, yeah. Which,
to those listeners, it was home base was exactly what it was named. It was where every subculture could go, and like there were shows there that you ran. It was a warehouse where fucking hardcore bands played, like the big, like Glassjaw played there, fucking you name it. We had fests there that still ring in infamy.
I am touring on Madonna right now with a guy who's our lighting director, and he's knows about Wilkes-Barre Fest. We talked about Wilkes-Barre Fest on our bus. Like, he knows about fucking Wilkes-Barre Fest, and he knows that I just couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, you fucking know. Like, I couldn't believe it. He's one of his buddies. He played there at Wilkes-Barre Fest. He plays in punk bands still. I forget which band it was. He named the band, and I reached out to Bob Mack. I was actually like, do you know this band? And he's like, yeah, of course. I'm like, oh my God.
But the whole, like, the whole home base of it all, like, how much farther into between when you and Vito are still playing Kitchens and that occurred?
It was really close because, yeah, say it was like 15 years old, right? We heard this stuff. By the time I was 17, I got kicked out of my house for selling ketamine. Mm-hmm. I was selling ketamine, and my aunt's boyfriend found it. I had quit high school already to DJ. My aunt let me quit high school. I was making money DJing and like traveling around doing gigs, and I just really wanted to spend my time doing it. And I used to just sit up in my bedroom, like I had this walk-in closet. I turned my dresser on the side, and I just would listen to techno songs all day long. And me and Campus used to have one turntable each, and we would let the other guy borrow it for like a week. Like one time I tried to keep him from getting it, and I didn't want to give it back to him. He crawled in my window, and I was there. And he busted me.
The fucking blonde head coming through the window.
He was so fucking good. He fucking busted me. He's like, I'm not letting this fucker get the turntable. It's my day to get it. You know, he came to get it. We still laugh about that. And there I was in the kitchen ready to meet him. Just trying to dodge him. Yeah, and then there were... You know, we were just really experimenting also with a lot of drugs at that time as kids. Like, we got turned on all these drugs, and people were doing heroin and crack, all kinds of shit. But, like, I was really just in the psychedelics at the time, and I was selling ketamine. Mm-hmm. And my aunt's boyfriend found it and told my aunt it was crack, and I got kicked out of the house at 17, and I moved in with Vince.
Yeah.
Vince let me live in his house, and then I didn't have a job or anything. We used to go like soup kitchens and shit. We used to steal food out of the supermarket to like eat sometimes. Like, we just didn't have anything. And Vince got me a job making the tattoo needles, like soldering the tattoo needles. So I learned how to solder. Mm-hmm. And then that was 17 years old. And then between 17, 18, and 19, we were throwing our own little renegade raves and all that kind of stuff. We started a record label. And then Franco, who owned the tattoo shop, he saw me doing all that stuff. So he was like, so business-minded. He was like, why don't we open up a location where you guys could do this? And the idea at first was just a record store. And then we're like, well, maybe we do a record store where we can do, like, because he had those game studios where he sold video games. He sold those, like, Magic the Gathering games. And then also was a place for the kids to be and use it all, right? They had, like, this safe haven to, like, geek out on this stuff. So I think he took that model and he was like, why don't we just make a youth place for you guys? Like, you guys are smart, you're savvy, you're really skilled, you're already doing all this music stuff. Like, why don't you just take it to another level? And we were like, yeah. So he put up $5,000 and Vince put up $5,000 and was like, great, if we could pay this back, awesome. If not, whatever. And then, like, we never paid him back. Like, he just left at some point. He was like, look, guys, you guys keep this. If you end up making money, this doesn't make me enough money to, like, fuck with this. He's opening up more and more tattoo shops and pawn shops and things, right? But he, like, he taught me so many amazing things. Like, I remember him sitting me down and saying, like, you know, doing business with your friends is going to always be such a hard thing. Like, just shared with me, like, where really value lies, and, like, told me, like, don't ever burn a bridge. Like, you never know how you're going to end up in relationship with somebody later on in life. Like, don't ever burn a bridge for some dumb business shit. Like, maintain your relationships, you know, maintain your friendships and the things that you value. It's going to be really hard decision-making to have moral judgment and be like, get involved with things with money. And like, I really took those kind of things to heart even as I got older. And I made so many choices based on him saying that to me later in my life that like always weren't the most financially sound, but they, I felt like I was acting with integrity and I felt like I was doing the right thing. And I always had this anchor of Franco, like kind of saying that to me in my heart and like remembering him, like always like, you know, he told me that for a really good reason. He was this really unique person in a short period of my life, right? He died quite young.
Yeah, sadly. And
he was just a really unique person in our life that saw, really saw who we were and what we cared about and gave us this incredible support that nobody else was willing to do at that time. Nobody else. You know, like, yeah, it was just supposed to be a record store at first. And we were going to do raves. And then, like, we were doing, but like, I couldn't sell enough records in that location, especially dance music, like underground. It was so ahead of its time for any of this kind of area. And you, like, you had to know where it was. You, not like you were just going to be like, oh, I'm at the square and I'm going to walk in the record store. No, you had to get there. You had to, like, make your way by the train tracks and shit. Like, you had to really know we were there to go there. So somebody would come by and check out records and then they'd come 2 weeks later and almost all the same records are there. We didn't buy many new. Like, after a while, we didn't have a budget to keep buying them. Like, we're going to spend all of our money that we have saved to just buy records, right? And I had, like, choose them from the distributor. It was like all this shit I had to learn as a young kid too. Like, how do you fucking deal with a distributor? How do you get records? How do you do the, what's a LLC? What are these business things, right? Like, I had to figure all these things out and just wing it, kind of
figuring out what a one stop is and getting your RA together. And when you haven't sold anything, like, yeah, there's a lot.
There were so many things, right? It was like, it was just, that became kind of overwhelming, honestly. And then I was like, fuck this record store shit. Like, this is not enough money coming through. We don't sell enough. Like, and then we just kind of sold them off and gave them to my friends and stuff. And we ended up buying them. We had really good stuff, but like, it was so expensive, you know, like people just wouldn't buy it. It wasn't a thing that we did well. Then we got like those video games in and started opening it up to like rehearsals. Albatross started rehearsing there.
Yeah.
And the wrestling people came by. And Bob Mack came by and he wanted to book punk shows. And he was so helpful and came at such a ripe time when we were like really like just trying to find good people to partner with and survive. Like, we were just on our like on an edge, on an edge at some point. And he came by and like was doing the shows and he really just gave a shit and he was so good. And I remember like at one point we were just like, Bob, we don't know how to thank you for doing this. We just want to give you a part of the company, like just make you a partner. And like, we just split the money when we get money. And, you know, we just kind of brought him in as a partner, as like a thank you. Like, it doesn't have any value, right? But right. If we make money, then you'll just have some of it.
But the thing was, like, I don't know if you even remember this, but like the precursor to an Albatross was Hudok, Hans, myself, Nate Bevan, and Little Jake from an Albatross. We were in another band called the Distalysis Compendium. We were like this, like, freak out.
I don't remember that.
Jam, like, Neurosis metal style band. And we practiced there and played a bunch of shows there. And then when that splintered, an Albatross started.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the lineage of that.
Yeah, we had so many weird things in those little rooms. I remember we had this goth guy one time. He was like a synth nerd and he had all these synths. And he was the first person I ever saw using like a DAW to program synths. And he would just love to dress up like goth shit and go to these goth clubs on the weekends. But he was into like really interesting synth music. And he was the first person ever to rent the room out for a little bit, was that guy. Yeah, Bob Lewis had a little studio there for a little bit. You remember that?
Yep.
Bob Lewis had his little studio. Yeah, I mean, God, those were the fucking days I first saw a computer. Like, I used to be against computers with music. I'd be like, ah, it's fucking computer things, fake sounds. And I got all that tape machines and all this gear and stuff. But like, then, like, Franco bought a computer, E-Machines, and I learned how to use Acid in, like, 1998. And like, I was blown away. I was like, holy fuck, all the things you could do with this shit. I was like fucking thinking I was Aphex Twin and shit immediately. Yeah, like, I was just so blown away by all the little micro edits, all these things you could do, right? Like, but then I crashed the fucking E-Machines computer. I bounced the song and the computer never worked again.
Yeah. it's amazing. Now, like, you could record entire albums on this fucking laptop I'm on right now. No problem.
Shit, you know, you like bounce 1, 2, 3 tracks or something. It was like fucking over. E-machines, they weren't really made for doing anything but getting on the internet at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they were business machines.
Yeah, they were like little business machines. Exactly. That's why we had one, like, just to take care of the bookkeeping and these things.
So, like, pretty soon, like, in the mix of all that, you end up in an Albatross then.
Yeah, because they were so weird, and, like, I had my synths, and they were open to just, like, me just going nuts with them, like, adding synth sounds and stuff, right? And it's like, there was nobody that would play around like that kind of stuff that was coming through there, really, right? They were just kind of radically open to things, and I just liked, there was something I liked about how wild they were, right? Like, I didn't particularly like the music.
Yeah, it was grindcore. I mean,
I liked them.
Yeah.
You know, like, I liked how kooky they all were together, and like, just the weird juxtapositions that was happening there. That's what I liked about it, right? So I was like, I could be an addition to the juxtapositioning.
Yeah. But the thing is like, they were all very distinct personalities, and it was all very wild, but it was like, it was our core group of friends. It's not, it worked. There was,
it worked.
The reciprocity was our, like an affection for one another. It's you know, that was the whole point. And that band takes you on tour for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were those early days like for you? Because I didn't get to go with you guys ever because I already had a kid. I was already a father.
I didn't know anything, so it was kind of fun. It was the first time I ever did it. But it was like winter, and like we almost got an accident, I remember. Like Jimmy was driving the fucking van, and we got like just flipped around with the what's that thing in the back? The trailer fucking almost falls off and loses a wheel. So I don't remember. I was like sleeping, and like we just were spun out and on the side of the road all of a sudden. But yeah, it was just, there was a lot of like, remember going, being in the cold, being at Southwest Southwest for the first time, like seeing that stuff and setting up the shows really hard. We had to do all these things ourselves. And then you get like the guy, not all the guys want to load in and load out with you, you know? So there's like not people not helping and shit, and you're getting mad at each other, you know, this kind of like little petty little things. Like then one guy's doing the merch and this and that, and there's a van, you got this, and you got a place to sleep, and it's just fucking hard. I remember, like, they didn't smoke weed at the time. Only Hudok smoked weed a little bit.
Yeah.
So I had to smoke weed outside the van and shit. Like, they wouldn't let me smoke a joint anywhere. Like, they were really, like, they were more tight. Like, you know, like, they're kind of known as, like, a psychedelic guys now.
Yeah, and they were like, mostly straight edge at that point.
They did it at the time, though, when I went on that first tour. Like, they wouldn't take any acid with me or nothing. But they were open. They were psychedelically curious at the time.
Yeah.
Hudok was definitely the one partaking with me, and he would like smoke weed. Hey, let's go smoke each other, right? But we didn't do it in the freezing. I have some pictures from that tour of like me and Hootie smoking bowls outside in the freezing cold. Like, I remember one time, I don't know how, I was like selling weed or something. I must have stashed $300 in my winter jacket on this little pocket here, and we were on that tour, and we were just like going in the pocket, and I was like, yo, I got fucking $300 in this pocket. It was like such a godsend on the tour. I don't know where it even came from. I had stashed it somewhere, I guess, and just completely forgot about it. Maybe a previous winter or something. I don't know.
But that shit's my proof that you know, there are guiding forces in the universe that are taking care of us.
It was an amazing gift, you know. It was just like, oh wow, that's fucking extra $300 around this tour. We're broke and stuff, you know. It was like everything changed at that moment a little bit.
So how many years do you spend like in completion with an Albatross?
I mean, I don't know. I just kind of like played around. I was always interested in. We never had a drummer that could play to the click track.
Right.
So I always wanted to have drums like on a grid that I can really manipulate and synchronize lots of sequencing to. We never actually done that. I still would like to do that, actually. with them. Like, it's something I still would like to do, is like have it really programmed and dialed in and like really fucking really extreme, you know, really push the boundaries of the stuff even further. But I would just do like, we would try to head in those directions. I ended up doing like a lot of the segues and the weird intros and like, yeah, I don't know. We just listen and remix things. We made a mini CDs the one time, I remember, like, where it was like songs that I made with them and then songs that were just me remixing and tweaking their songs, or like have them come in my little studio and put effects on them all and just geek out. Like, yeah, they were always open, like really open to listen in unique ways. And Jake, like, I fucking love Jake.
Yeah.
I loved how Jake listens. I love his, like, he just has a fucking radical way of seeing sound. And he's so in his craft.
Yeah.
Like, he's such a genius in his craft, right? Like, Jake, for me, was a lot of that sound.
Oh, for sure.
Right?
For like, sure. I played in bands with Jake when he was still in high school, because I'm a bit older than him. We played in grindcore bands together when I was in the grindcore band Feculence way back in the day.
I remember that name.
Yeah. So I kind of like stole him for Feculence and, and kind of brought him to Hoodock and everybody. And like, I recognized right away with him that he was very insular and very focused.
Genius.
But brilliant. Like,
yeah.
So brilliant that he actually self-destructs with his own brilliance. And that, I think, is like, I still try and find him and shake him out of his shell, but he's gotten to the point now where he won't come out and play.
I've had a couple good conversations with Jake, actually, like the past few years. Like, we just connect and then we get on a phone call. Like, we had some really great conversations, actually.
Yo, he's brilliant. He's just, it's refreshing to talk to someone with that very instinctual level of talent, and his view on creation is mind-blowing sometimes, because it's so it happens so simply sometimes, I think, for him, that he doesn't understand how mind-blowing it is for everyone else.
Yeah, and that's what, yeah. You know, you remember Johnny used to have that Edison record label?
Yeah, of course.
What the shirt said on the back? There was never a genius without a tincture of madness.
That's it. Yes.
That's on Johnny's shirts.
With the three faces on the front. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and I always, that was the first time I ever heard of that phrase. And like, I tell you, I think about it all the time, right? All the artists I work with, there's a madness in all of them. And there's also, they also possess this incredible genius. And just like, it's a part of some kind of eccentric thing that's a recipe for good artists. I don't know why, but it just is. Like, I know some people, they're so great at their instruments, but they can't have a conversation.
Yeah.
Right?
They're like savants.
They're just so damn good, though, right? Like, they're just so interesting, but they have like this, the other part of their life is just, that's what they're built to do in the world. Like, they need somebody else to take care of the rest of the parts, and they need to just focus on their art. Yeah. That's why I think the most successful artists just have really good management.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think we had like this scarcity mentality. I mean, I know I did, and some of my friends, like Campus, Vince, like we grew up so poor, and like we were always like in this scarcity mentality, like somebody's gonna take our things, or you know, like we had to steal things. Like, there was just all this energy of like, it was such scarcity and such poverty. Like, people were so poor that like, I think we weren't into sharing our things so much. We didn't know how to share well. We didn't learn how to share, because we all grew up in this like tight poverty that like, when we would get into places where we would find new things out, we would kind of hoard them a little bit, you know, to protect them, or like not want to tell everybody about it. And I think those kind of things stunted our group of people in our art, because like, we didn't understand like what it was to actually help each other out and have teams of management and things like this that really work together and have all these functions. Like, we just had these, like, somebody would discover something and then tell everybody else about it, and everybody would do that one thing, not realizing that there's a billion ways to execute that, and everybody can participate in their own unique way. We didn't have those skill sets as kids to know that that was true. So we were holding on to this like scarcity. And I always feel like, I talk with Campus about this a lot, like now, and I just say, like, you know, we had like a scarcity mentality for so long because of our poverty, that like, we didn't support each other on our paths when we were younger. I feel like in the most appropriate ways for our best growth.
That makes sense, because you don't grow up in a manner in which, you know, community becomes the premium.
Yeah.
You're too worried about survival. You're in survival mode.
Competition was the premium.
Yeah. Yeah. But just getting by, getting by, be just taking care of oneself. And
yeah.
I think even like my growing up in a large family may have been a slight leg up in that, but we were very poor too.
Yeah.
So there was always like, I'm getting that last bite of fucking whatever's for dinner.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They were like sharks. And that stunts you, and it doesn't make for a very creative environment.
No, like I realize now, like I find like I work with people who are aligned in my values, and like sometimes we do things that are unimaginable. I couldn't even imagine we do, but it's just because we all really care and we all have our values aligned so much, and we're willing to share in these things and figure stuff out together, knowing that there's enough for all of us.
Where was the point where that broke though for you? Like you're stuck in that mentality when you're younger, and you're doing home base, and then you get into an albatross. Is there a point in that whole stew where it?
Or just honestly, us doing all that stuff together as kids, right? Like throwing the raves together, and just us figuring out things amongst ourselves on our own as youth. It was quite empowering. Although we still had this like competitive nature with how we did things, we still did it, you know, and it was that there. I saw like what's possible, right? Like, and then there'd be examples of other people, like Spiral Tribe sound systems and people and these crews and stuff that we saw. Like, wow, they were doing like these big movements where the government in the Europe was against them for doing free events, and like they took it onto this whole other ethos of anarchism and stuff, right? And activism kind of crossed over into those worlds, and that stuff made more sense to me, right? It was like, oh wow, like we're actually, Joe Biden made the Rave Act, right, around like 99 or whatever, and the raves went into clubs, and they got out of the like that's the scene where you could just go to any random building and throw a rave, because the promoter was going to get, if anybody got caught with drugs, the Rave Act said that if anybody got caught with drugs, the promoter was the one that got in trouble.
Yeah.
So the promoter, it was like the perfect recipe for them to stop doing the events. Then they went into clubs where the club owners were now selling the drugs, and fucking it was all in cahoots. That changed, and everybody left and went to Berlin.
Yeah, that's when Berlin popped.
Everybody I know moved to fucking Berlin. The record stores closed in New York City, and everybody moved to Berlin. And I was like, fuck, like I was watching that happen and like thinking like I was DJing and making money and had my little venue, and I thought like, this is not going to work out. Like this is fucked. Like there's no way I'll ever make a livelihood doing this shit. Like I don't think I could do this stuff. Like I had to start really reimagining like if I wanted to make a livelihood, like what was I going to do? You know, like that was after I went on the first Albatross tour. It was like, I had conversations. I remember Phil and these guys, and like my friend Aaron, do you remember this guy, Aaron Luca? He was like a player that would hang out.
Yeah.
Aaron went to Full Sail and he called me and he was like, you got to come down here. All the shit you're into, MIDI, all these things are recorded. They teach it there. And like, I didn't know that fucking music schools existed. I didn't know art schools existed. I didn't know engineering schools existed. Nobody told me about anything like that in school, and I had quit by the time I was in 10th grade. If people told me I could have done that shit, I probably would have stayed in school, right? Like, so I immediately went and got a GED, and my mom helped me, my mom's boyfriend at the time, husband, helped me co-sign a student loan to get to be able to go. And then I ended up just deciding, like, hey, I'm just going to go and learn how to engineer for real, right? And like, I was working at Murray's Inn as an engineer. But, like, I just knew how to, like, work shit that I taught myself. Like, I didn't really know what thing. I didn't know how to work a compressor. I didn't really know what these things really did, you know? I knew how to, like, set up the mic and, like, fucking plug it in and turn the EQ. But I didn't really know what I was doing or what I was hearing, or I just could get the shit going in a flim-flam way. We could do a show, right? Yeah. And then like people are yelling and screaming. Everybody's kind of just figuring it out as we go. And that always, it was always like that. You know, it was always a chaotic, all right, let's figure it out. Great, okay, got one mic. All right, let's go. Boom, boom. You know, like we bought the cheapest $3 mics we could because they'd all get broken. And so, but like I had a good skill set. I knew I was developing like a skill set, and I would read manuals, and I was soldering. I was making my own synthesizers and learning how to solder. Like I just had a good skill set. So I thought, I don't know how to take this to a different level. I kind of like feel like I'm maxing out my potential here in this little Murray's complex. I don't really know what to do. And I don't want to go on a fucking another punk tour because this is not going to be a good life. This is not going to be a good life. I'm not going to be fulfilled going on punk tours. I could just tell by the first one. And I remember sitting on that little pool table with Olivan Albatross and being like, should I go, guys? And they were like, you should go. You should do it, you know? And then, like, I did it. I went there and got a good, like, education and just really took all the time, picked my teacher's brains and, like, really just studied so hard and learned everything I could possibly soak up. And I had, like, when I got out of there, I had the confidence that I had a good skill set that I could go try to find work. That started working in New York City when I went there.
So what age are you when you go to New York City?
I was 23 when I was at home base, and I had just smoked DMT for the first time.
Oh yeah.
and I had really this profound experience where like, there was this guy, Fred. Do you remember this kid, Fred? He looked like Herman. He looked like a monster. I forget his last name.
I do too, but I remember Fred. I remember Fred. Yeah, I got Fred DMT from DMT Fred
around, and like we had known about DMT from like High Times magazines and shit. You know, like like the lore with DMT was like, if it ever you don't look for it, it'll find you. And like when it comes around, that's when you do it. And like I remember Vince, he had his little studio there, and I had my studio. And Fred was there, and he was like, Vince came into my room. He was like, Carl, you have to try this, bro. Holy shit, you have to do it. And I'm just like, I never saw Vince like that. Like he was so adamant. And I was like, okay, great, let's do it. I'll try it. And I was kind of nervous. And Brooke was there, and Campus, and little Matt.
Yeah.
Like I had to fucking take, you know, like, just take one big hit. You know, they put it on some weed, and I was like in my little studio chair, and I had like these like corrugated like things for soundproofing, the egg cartons on the walls.
Yep.
Remember all the patterns just turned into like these squares, and I felt like I was going down this tunnel. And it was one of the most significant moments in my life, I have to say. Like it changed my life from that point on, right? I was closing up home base. I got approved to the school. It was like everything was kind of wrapping it all up. We were gonna go on one more cross-country trip and close home base, go on our cross-country trip. And then that was it. I had this little Astro van, and me, Campus, Brooke, Matt, Ranji, and Fred were all going across the country, right? And so I'd taken the first DMT hit, and then I thought, like, I didn't have any thoughts, actually. I just totally went into this other place. But the first thought that came to me was, oh my God, I died. I smoked that shit and I fucking died.
Oh, fuck.
I thought that I died, right? It was so real. And what was crazy was that I was okay with it. I was like, oh, like, this is that place, like, everybody tries to get to. Like, this is a place all the religions talk about. Like, I fucking, oh my God, like, I made it. It was like, oh fuck, but like an accident, but I was okay with it, right? I settled into it for some, I don't know how, but like that was the thought was like, okay, I died. All right, I'm gonna have to be with this. And the second thought was, I'm not gonna hear music anymore. And then the third thought was, and I'm not gonna see anybody I love. And then like my vision was like, tunnelly and kind of coming back, and like I like saw like Brooke's face, and I remember grabbing her face and at the same time like taking in a breath and like saying, you're here, oh my God, you're here. And I thought she was where I was, but really I was coming out of the trip. And then it all hit me. Like, I remember I was me breathing, alive, in a body. I smoked the DMT. She's not where I am. I'm actually didn't even fucking leave the room. I'm not dead. Holy shit. Oh my God. Wow. 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 And I just kept looking at everybody going, what? And little Matt was so scared. He just kept backing up. And he's like, and I'm like, Matt, oh my God. And like Roxy, my little dog, was there. And like, I remember thinking like, I could communicate with Roxy so good. And everybody was like, no, Roxy's going to run outside. And I was like, she's not going to run outside. Come on, Roxy, let's go outside. And like, I ran outside with her and I could just tap into her. And like, she wouldn't run away from me for the first time ever. And Matt would not come up to me. He was so scared because they said I was just going like this. I had my eyes closed and I was doing this. I think I was trying to climb out of the place where I was. I was like trying to get, like, climb out, but I was on my chair. So Matt sometimes in campus will still bust my balls to this day, and they'll just be like hanging out and they'll be doing this. But that moment was so significant for me because I lost my sense of fear. I did something to where I was like, I remember we were going on that trip driving, and I even have a cassette tape still to this day of the recording of, like, I guess we're arguing, and I'm like, you can't be scared to die. When we're going to die, we're just going to die, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it anyway, so there's no point in being scared. Like, I'm arguing with them on the validity of being scared to die or not and why we shouldn't worry about risking it. And, like, I'm fucking 23 years old, right? But, like, I realize, like, I had just personally lost my own ability to confront that fear and it controlled me, right? And I was like, okay, like, the thoughts would be like, oh, you're gonna die? Okay, so I'm gonna do, okay, so like what happened? Every fear thought would, I would just follow it back to, I'm gonna die. But then I'd be like, well, if I'm gonna die and go to that thing will happen, like, that's not even that bad. That's not even that bad of a deal. So it really, like, made me have this different relationship with fear. Where it was like it couldn't hold its ground anymore like it used to and make me worry.
And the thing is, like, people that they go on these ayahuasca pilgrimages and things of that nature, and they're taking ayahuasca essentially to tap into DMT.
Yeah.
Or a version thereof, which is already endogenous to the human body. You create it. Your body takes it and accepts it so easily. That's why you don't hear about too many bad trips on DMT. It's already kind of there, you know? So, like, once you experience DMT for the first time, to me, I think it opens, like, for better or worse, your third eye.
Yeah, I mean, that's the lore.
Yeah, I believe it. And I believe it because I've smoked DMT.
Yeah.
And my experience with it was very visual, very, very positive, and almost, I don't want to call it humorous, but
no, I know what you mean. Humorous in the, like, the jestery kind of mischievous way.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But that's only with the NN DMT. When you use 5-MeO DMT, it's a completely different experience. I prefer now the 5-MeO DMT experience. I use it a lot to meditate. I use it to assist in meditation. It's fucking the most galactic thing. And I think it's the highest spiritual technology going. I got a DMT electronic pen and Ram Dass loving awareness meditation. This is the highest spiritual technology for me identifying with loving awareness. And, like, I don't know. It's like, it's such a great tool for meditation. I mean, it's galactic.
How do you quantify one or the other, though? Because my experience is only with the former, not the latter, because it wasn't it just wasn't. Well,
there's no visual element like that. Like, you don't have this, like, cartoony visual sensation. The 5-MeO has this, like, softness, and especially when you have, like, the pen, because it's much more potent than 5-MeO in lesser amounts. So your dosage amount is a lot smaller. So you could take too much if you're not dosing it right and you're putting it in a pipe or whatever, right? But when you have a pen, like the electronic version of it, you can like gradient into the experience. So sometimes there's this hesitation of like being nervous or like, you know, you're going to lose your ego. But then you kind of just sip it. You take like a little sip, I just say, and you feel the sensation over your body that gets really calm. And that's a gateway to the meditative state. Like that's not, you're not totally gone. And then when you feel good enough, I also like to sit upright and erect so that I don't go settle back in this full let go experience, but I focus on breathing and identifying with loving awareness.
That's heavy.
And then that just like, you know, it just vibrates into every molecule of my being, in every like fiber of existence, I feel like. And then I like breathe like this breath. And I just feel like I'm putting it from my soul out into the world. And I could feel it. It's so visceral, right? There's like, I'm like, oh yeah, you know, like Ram Dass taught me to identify with loving awareness. Like identify with it, right? It was like, think you're of it, like become of it. Like, he's like, you know, like, I want you to say, and when you introduce yourself, you could say, I'm Carl outwardly, but inwardly you're going to identify with loving awareness. And I just really trusted him. And so I did it, and it like became this like kind of inward joke to me, like, oh my God, it really works. Like I just do this I am loving awareness thing, and I play with it in my mind as a thought. And then like whatever other thought is making me feel sad or whatever kind of thing I'm caught in, this thought is stronger. And then it has to do with this identity, right? And I'm like, it kind of becomes flippant in my head, like, anything in my awareness I could love, right?
Yeah.
I am this thing that is loving my awareness, right? I am this thing that is loving aware, right? There's so many ways your mind starts flipping it when you repeat it like a mantra. So it became so flippant in my head that it became like so silly with it at times, right? And I would just like laugh, like, I can't believe I'm doing this. And I also can't believe that it works.
Well, I mean, think about it this way. The Vedics have been doing this for thousands of years.
Yeah.
There's obviously a validity to it and an efficacy to it, because it wouldn't be practiced to this very day otherwise. Very simple.
Yeah.
What I wonder, though, is like along your journey, like you go to school, what awakens that spirituality in you that you sought Ram Dass?
I think it was a clear path of like fucking Hare Krishna songs from Shelter.
Yep.
Right? Bringing that inquiry into my mind of like all the, you go listen to Saranagati, go listen to any of those fucking records, right? Like search quest for certainty, mm-hmm. right? Like you listen to those songs and you just take that stuff into consideration for a day. It's going to turn you on to some new thoughts for sure, right? And yeah. Then, like, we take psychedelics and we have this experience of the rave and this personal sense of interconnectedness, right? And, like, and then you got, like, all my hippie friends, like Dana Decker and, like, all these people, right? That they're, like, into the hippie thing, also taking me to Grateful Dead shows and, like, seeing that stuff simultaneously, right? And campus giving me Be Here Now when we were younger and Behold a Pale Horse and like Noam Chomsky, and we're like reading these really wild thoughts and combining them with psychedelics, and you like start to think in these ways, right? Timothy Leary was around at that time. We were just like, I don't know, there were just cool weird things that I thought was interesting. And it wasn't really until my mother committed suicide in 2007 that those things came alive for me, right? Because it was like, it was just words and concepts and things, right? And I had done this like self-inquiry, and like it kind of made sense as ideas, right? Like they made sense as ideas, but I didn't have a teacher for one, and I didn't have anywhere to, I felt like I could apply it besides my thoughts, right? It was like, it wasn't, I didn't know how to apply that, any of those things to life. And then when my mom died, I had like this toolkit, I realized. Like, I had these, all these things in my head that I could refer to about death and life and dying and how to show up. And I was able to, like, I was in Trinidad and Tobago doing like a concert with Mary J. Blige. My brother called me, you know, my mom had just committed suicide. It was like, oh my God, it was just fucking so heavy. And I had just been in Maui right before that. And I thought, like, I went up to the top of Haleakala on my 28th birthday and I thought, I'm just going to bring my mom here and she'll want to live. And I'm just going to show her this sunrise. It's so beautiful above the clouds like this. She'll for sure want to live if I show her this. It's just too miraculous. And you can always see it if you're alive, right? That's what I thought. And then I went 4 days later to go do this show and she did it. So I couldn't get out of there. I couldn't leave. And I remember, like, just hearing, like, thinking of Ram Dass's teachings. I would listen to him talk a lot on these tapes and shit. And, like, he would talk about this thing of Ramana Maharshi when he was dying of cancer and his devotees were like, don't leave us. And he was like, where could I possibly go? And, like, I remember just standing out there at the ocean and, like, on, we had this, like, we're on this island, Tobago, and there's this ocean there. And it's just my first year of touring ever in the world, right? I'm, like, so far away from home and I can't go anywhere. I can't get on a plane. I can't do anything. My mom's dead somewhere in on a fucking highway in Pennsylvania, you know? Like, it was just so surreal. And I could just hear that in my head. I just said to Danny, like, my best friend at the time, still my best friend, I just said, where could she possibly go, Danny? I was just, like, looking out there on the ocean, like, all the waves on the ocean. I was just like, where could she possibly go? Like, really, there's nowhere to go. Like, we know this. And all those things started to come alive as, like, whoa, like, all these things I knew spiritually or had inquired, I felt like they were more true. And then there was just this framework of, like, me being able to work with that stuff. And then, like, okay, how do I show up? How do I got to call the guy that freaking hit my mom and let him know we don't think he killed her, right? Like, he was, and then, like, that conversation was amazing. He was going through all this trauma, and, like, he was like, yeah, for your mom's face. And I was like, I just want you to know, like, me and my brother don't think, we want you to know that we don't think you killed our mom. Like, she wanted to die. And we want you to know that too. Because you might be thinking we hate you. Yeah. You know, like, so it was amazing.
Can you imagine? Can, like, you imagine the peace you brought that human being?
Dude, I know. I think about it now, having conversation. I think, thank God we had the wherewithal to have this conversations. But it was like, because I was so rooted in these things that I didn't really know, I hadn't have a place to express it, but it came alive in those moments. And my, the value of my life and spirituality and telling people I love them and making sure people know that I care about them changed for me then, right? It's like, my mom knew those things, but I didn't communicate with my mom like that all the time. Like, she had a really hard life and mental issues and things, right? So, like, that kind of relationships and expressing myself, and, like, it was more pushed away at the time, right? And tell people I love them. And now I tell everybody I love them.
Yeah.
You know, all the time. I have no shame, right, in this kind of things at all. Like, it used to be more shameful. It wasn't a thing, like, my family did, and all the manipulation of things in the family and how we grew up in our weird structures. It was more shame. There was more shame around that stuff, to be honest, than there was, like, strength in it. It was like a manipulative things. People might say that, not mean it, right? That's how I thought.
Yeah.
Until I realized, like, oh my God, it's so important to communicate these things, right? Everybody needs to know. I'm never going to not anybody let them not know that I'd love them. Like, Eric Cammer died the same way, right? Like,
yeah. Like, yeah.
Right. He was the first person that committed suicide that I knew. Right. He set up all his paintings in this room in this certain way. And, like, he was telling me, like, he made his painting about death, and he used to go behind it, and it said, it can happen to you, on the painting, and he had those eyes cut out.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Cameron, what is that about, bro? And he was like, it's death. You see, anybody could be behind it. And I was like, my God, you're like a fucking genius the way you think of this stuff, like the way he would get it out. And I watch him paint, like, he was just so amazing to me. His creativity was bubbling, but he was tormented by his own mental voices, like just like my mom. He would say the same things to me like my mom would say, like, I just don't want to hear the voices. And I was like, huh? Like, and I'm here taking psychedelics, eating acid all the time. I don't hear no voices.
Yeah.
And they're like, I can't wrap my head around what that is. Like, and I didn't have a skill set back then. Like I do now. If I was to encounter somebody like that, I could deal with it in such a more healthier way where I could, I just have so much more resources for that kind of engagement, you know? Like,
yeah.
Back then it was so confusing to me, like trying to just wrap my head around what they even might be thinking. Like, it's so far fetched. Like, how could they ever want to kill themselves? We're having so much fun.
But like when Eric did that, you know, All any of us could talk about was like, dude, how come he didn't say anything? Like, everybody kept saying, like, how come he didn't say anything? I was like, Eric Cameron's been saying something.
He said things all the time to us.
Fucking
he
did years.
Times. Yeah. Yeah.
But we were kids. We were young.
Yeah.
And we didn't, none of us had those skill sets. None of us were, you know, invested enough in the ether to even, you know, quantify what could possibly be going on with any one of us. Yeah. We were all worried about what was going on right here.
I know.
And that's where that sense of community that you're talking about and that empathy, that true empathy, not just, I know how he feels.
Yeah.
Like, I feel it because he feels it.
Yeah.
And that's the difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's like, you know, where you're coming from, but like not in a self-flagellating manner either, you know, where you're taking it on, you're just flowing through it, and it's yeah, I don't think it affects you.
Seva, you know, in this attitude of seva, they have selfless service. It's a word we learn around us, teaches a lot about seva. And I used to just think it was like, okay, doing things for free. Some people think it's doing, but I realize it's an attitude in which you do things. It's a selfless attitude in which you do things. It could be anything. Anything you do selflessly is in an attitude of seva. It's towards a higher purpose. You realize that there's a higher thing going on between me and this being, and I just have to serve their needs right now because that's what must be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a selfless act, and it's the attitude in which you do the act. It's not like, it's not the fact that you're doing something, but it's, we can do anything that way, right? You can give somebody a cup of tea in the attitude of seva. You can, right? We can serve anything. What we're serving is like this thing that's moving through all of us that we recognize is not, we're not separate from. That's what we're really serving.
Yeah. And when people do things out of like what they call charity, even if they don't think they're, you know, making themselves look good or adding to the karma pool, a lot of times they do it because they feel like if I were this person, that's what I would need. And that's still not
right.
That's still not selflessness.
Yeah. Yeah. Ram Dass has a great book called How Can I Help? And he goes into the minutiae of these kind of things because he was a therapist for a long time. And he would say like, oh, I needed sick people for me to have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't in my best interest to heal them because I would be out of work.
Yeah.
And that was a threat to my own existence and my own ego. Not until he could truly go into this thing, he said, to have this attitude of services, to ask, how can I help? Right? Like, not like, hey, I'm going to help you. Because the attitude, when we come in with this thing of like, I'm going to help you. I'm so great. I'm such a helper. Right?
Yeah.
That exchange is felt energetically between the offering and the person receiving it. Right? And he said it should be in the attitude of one hand washing the other. Right? Like, one hand doesn't thank the other hand for washing it or think it's helping it in some extra way. It's just what must be done to wash your hands.
Yeah.
And when we take that kind of attitude, I think that's where miracles occur, actually. I think that's where that's how we start to play in the field of the miraculous. When we trust in that kind of exchange, that like there's something greater going on between us all, and I have to show up this way because I trust in that thing, and this is how it works.
To me, like approaching life in general with that very attitude, it probably speaks a lot to where you've arrived in your life. Because like starting from, you know, very meager beginnings, and then, you know, working through like playing in punk bands and doing electronic music, and then you go to school and you end up with like Mary J. Blige. That is still, I remember when it first happened for you, and all of us were like, dude, that is like the coolest fucking thing I've ever heard in my life. How the fuck did, like, this, we grew up with this fucking kid. How's he doing this? And like, it, I asked myself that for about maybe a split second. Then I was like, well, yeah, it's Carl. Of course, that's the way it went down. Because although you had your struggles, internally and externally, like living the life that we were all kind of leading at that point, you always, as I'd said right at the beginning, you were always a seeker. And I don't know, it just, it made sense to me that you ended up that way. But how did that all come to pass? Like finding yourself in the big leagues, so to speak.
Well, I just wanted, I am in, and when I went to school, they were like, you got to either go to New York City or LA to get a gig, basically. Yeah. Or Nashville, right? And I was like, well, I'm not going to fucking go to LA. I don't know anything in LA. Kachmar lived in New York City, right? And Kachmar was like, come stay with me. And I had two friends from school. They also wanted to go to a city. So we were like, all right, let's figure this out. We actually all moved to PA at first. And we would like go out for job interviews. We got this like house in like fucking Plains, PA. Me and like one guy from Nebraska and a guy from Florida. We all lived in fucking Plains, PA for a little bit. And I was going through a breakup with Brooke at the time. Like I had fucking gone through this crazy moment where I was like, she didn't want to be with me anymore. I was with her for like all my childhood, right? Like years of my childhood. It was my only girlfriend for like 9 years, 8 years at the time or something, 7 years. I don't remember what. It was a long time though for a 20-some-year-old kid. And I was so fucked up by that. I was like really sad. And so like we just kind of, I moved there because I kind of like wanted to figure out how to repair my relationship or like get my girlfriend back. And then they were close to New York City and they were trying to get jobs, but I was really kind of slacking. And then I got this call to this place called Dream Hire to go for an interview, and Kachmar let me sleep on his fucking floor to go to the interviews and stuff, like the kitchen floor. I remember I was sleeping on. He had this little place with his other buddy. There was nowhere to sleep, and like I slept on the little kitchen floor cubbyhole area. It worked for me. And I got the job interview, and then I got the job, and then we all ended up getting an apartment in Bushwick in it's like a really famous little area now where they have these apartments. I forget the Ave, Montrose Ave or something like that. But it was really dangerous at the time, but it was, we could afford it. We all lived together. Some of the people from my school, we all got like a big warehouse together. And I was making like $8 an hour, but I was working in New York City, and it was like this company that they fixed like Neve preamps and microphones and rented equipment, right? Yeah. So I got to see how the rental industry worked also, right? And I would go to all these studios, and that's where I saw like Pro Tools rigs and stuff like this. And like, I just was like, I was hungry as fuck. I was so hungry, and I wanted to make a living, and I wanted to work in music. And I didn't really know what I thought I wanted to be in the studio. But I couldn't do an internship because nobody could support my living. Yeah. So I had to make money because I had to start paying my student loans back already. Like you have to fucking immediately start paying these things back after 1 year. So I had to get some kind of job, and like that's $500 a month now. Like I'm just barely scraping by on everything, eating $5 fucking sandwiches at lunchtime, you know? And then like I would sit with this guy, Doug, all night, and we'd like hang out and listen to like 10-10 Winds. He did the night shift, and I'd go with him, and like we'd talk about the universe and listen to George Norrie.
George Norrie, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
We'd be like, that's my shit.
All this for, man. What's like, we'd have these great deep conversations, and then like we'd like rent little sound systems for each other. We'd borrow equipment from the place that we worked at. We'd rent it out in New York. We had these little hustles. And then I started getting gigs. This company called SIR called Dream Hire. We're like, we need a keyboard tech to send out to this like Macy Gray show. It was like at the Tribeca Film Fest. And I had these teachers who were Mary J. Blige's techs. They were MIDI techs. I tested out of MIDI, but I went and met them and had a conversation with them because I was so curious that you could be a MIDI technician. And I was really good with MIDI already, so I had skipped MIDI in the college, and I got my money back for the class, and that's where I bought my first laptop. And so I used the MIDI class to buy that, but I wanted to meet those guys since I wasn't going to have the class. I wanted to meet them because I thought they did such a cool job, and they both like shared this like sequencing playback and all the MIDI keyboards, and they managed it all. I was like, that's a job? And they were like, yeah, like you make the sounds and you manage all the keyboards and you set them up for the shows. And then like I ended up getting that exact job. Like they became teachers at Fool Sail more full time. I got sent on that Macy Gray show as a keyboard tech, and like they paid me like $350 for the day, and all I did was set keyboards up on a riser with fucking stands that these other guys set up. They were stage hands, and I just had to set the keyboards up, and like I'm reading manuals all night thinking I'm gonna have to program these things and I'm gonna have to know how to work them, and like I didn't have to do shit. I just had to set them up, plug them in, and the other techs for the band came and set the rest of the way up, loaded the sounds up, and I was like, oh my god. And I had met this guy Tom Permy, and he was like an old roadie guy, and he showed me how to like tie the cables well and like, you know, wrap the B3 cable around the leg and then plug it into the Leslie, just like these little things I never would have fucking even thought of.
Yeah.
And like I was just like, oh great. And he loved my work ethic and how enthusiastic I was. He was like probably 20, 30 years older than me. Yeah, because he's like 70-something now. I just went and visited him on my tour recently. We hung out. He's like fucking 79 years old, right? He's like 30 years older than me. And he went and told Ralph, the guy that booked me on the thing, like, this kid is awesome. Bring him back again, right? So then they put me on other jobs. Then they started calling me for a bunch of jobs. And, dude, I'm going from $8 an hour, where I'm getting like $250 a week after taxes, and this motherfucker's paying me $350 for the day to almost do nothing. So I'm taking these gigs anytime I can get them. I went like, anytime you guys give me these gigs, I want them. I'm taking them so much, and I'm taking off work from my normal job, right? And they're getting pissed at me. And they bring me in the office like, Carl, you can't keep taking the SIR gigs. We need you here. You just can't be doing it. I had my lunch break. SIR was two blocks away from Dream Hire. I went over to SIR and I said, Ralph, they don't want me doing gigs with you anymore. Can I just come work for you guys? And just like, and he was like, look, it's not really cool that you like, that we steal each other's things, but like, I'm going to make an exception here. Like, we really like having you here, and I think we can use you, and we're expanding over here, this new thing. And like, I was like, okay, great. And they made me like the QC checker. So I would just check the guitar amps and all the equipment that would come back from the gigs. I'd check and make sure they still worked. So like, I'd go in this soundproof room and fucking set up amplifiers and get stoned and fuck, okay, this one worked. Yeah, the distortion works. Like, just learn every amp and every single piece of gear, right? And like, just geek on it. And I was just in my bliss, right? And then they would send me out on the gigs whenever they had a gig, so I could, when I didn't have a gig, I could get paid hourly. And then when I did have a gig, boom, they send me, I get paid the day rate for the gig, you know, and they make some money off of it. They trust me. I know how to manage the orders. I know how to do the gigs. They like me out on the shows. And then I just started doing that a lot. And then I became like the manager of the keyboard department at some point. They let me manage the keyboard department. And then I was doing like one gig on New Year's Eve, 2006 going into 2007 New Year's, or 2005 into 2006, one of those years. And it was freezing cold out, and I was doing Mary J. Blige shows for like a week. She was like doing the like, and I can't be without you, babe, that song, like real big hit that she was doing at the time. And this guy AT, Alan Thompson, he was like, he just was like, I think you're ready to come out here, boy. He was like a Detroit dude, like fucking just this amazing, like cool cat from Detroit, like managed like Patti LaBelle and did her like tours, and like he did everything, so much things from Detroit, right? And he was doing Mary at the time, and he was like, I think you're ready to go on a tour, boy. Real southern thick accent, 18. Like, Carl, I think you're ready to come out with us. And I'd be like, oh man, like, that'd be a dream, you know, like because everybody that went to work at SIR, that's how they got, like somebody would pick them up on a tour, then they'd go touring. And I was just always asking them, I was like, how do you go on a tour? Like, how do you end up on a tour? I don't understand how you end up. And they're like, you'll end up on a tour, just keep doing this shit, trust me. And then finally AT asked me, and he gives me a business card. He's like, you want to come? You call me. I'm figuring out this tour here. And I was like, holy shit, like, I can go on a tour. And then I went back to the guys at SIR, and they were like talking to me, like, you don't know if you want to go on that tour, man. And then some people were like, fucking go, get the fuck out of here, go. And I was just like, yeah, I want to go see the world. Like, I'm going to go. And I told AT, yes, I'll take the tour. And he offered me $1,250 a week. And I was like, great, per diem and $1,250 a week guaranteed. Like, fuck yeah, right? So, like, they flew me out to California. We went to rehearsals, and, like, I started, like, being the keyboard tech. And I was like, I can't believe I got the job that the guys in Full Sail told me that they did. Like, it's the exact job they did. I'm the MIDI tech for Mary now. And I'm out. Like, you guys know these dudes, and they knew the dudes. The keyboard guys knew the dudes, you know? And I was like, I can't believe this. And then, yeah, I just, like, I had that job for 6 years. That was my first job touring. When I had that job for 6 years, I met my best friend there, who became the Pro Tools engineer, and I'm the godfather of his children now. Like, he has two children. I'm the godfather of both of his children. You know, like, we're like, me and his wife and him are like so close to each other, like my family, like some of my best friends in the universe. I met like on those things, like still people I still hang out with to this day. Like,
thus concludes part one of my two-part discussion with Carl Golombeski, Carl G. I had such a great time with Carl. I always do. I've loved being around him as long as I've been around him, and that's since early 90s. Just great guy. One of those people that you can't help but have a great time being around. I hope you enjoyed listening to this part one as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. Part two will be coming up later in the week. I want to not space it out so much so that I can sort of give them to you in rapid succession. So if you are hooked by this first part and we get into the real meat of the conversation in the back half, you won't have to wait so long for it. So, he's been Carl. I've been Peter. You've been beautiful. And from 3:33 a.m. Studios, this has been The Book, a Very, Very Bad Things podcast. Take it easy.